Ladies and gentlemen, we are about to start the ups and downs of band brand relationships panel. This is the final panel of the day four of the South by Southwest Music Conference 2012. And we ask that in respect to the panel that you silence any electronic devices of the noise-making sort. And, you know, give your full attention to our panel. And I will hand you over to your moderator, Ann Powers.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for clapping. Thank you, sir, for clapping. I feel very lucky today because in our pre-panel discussions, I realized that I can just be a quiet fly on the wall. These folks have it going on. They have a lot to say to each other about the issue of band-brand relationships, and I'm just going to have each introduce themselves. To my immediate right is Jasmine Valencia of Island Def Jam Music Group. Yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello, I'm Jasmine, and I do digital marketing, so I am the product manager for artists such as The Killers, Bon Jovi, Fall Out Boy, all the Fall Out Boy side projects, new artists such as Neon Trees, My Darkest Days, and the list goes on and on.
And next to Jasmine, we have Jeff Tamas from Cornerstone.
Hi, I'm Jeff. I'm the Senior Vice President of Creative and Strategy at Cornerstone.
You want to say one sentence about Cornerstone?
Sure. So we build brand strategies, music strategies for brands, and execute full 360-degree programs around those strategies for brands like Converse, Mountain Dew, Bushmills, and a number of other brands.
And next we have Jennifer Seisler from Sub Pop Records.
Hi, my name's Jen. I am Vice President of Licensing for Sub Pop, and I'm part of the Business Affairs Department, so I do all of the negotiating and contracts, but also do the creative licensing, pitching, and the branding kind of opportunities that come around as well. Sub Pop was the Seattle label that launched grunge in the late 80s, early 90s.
And does so much still.
It's very eclectic now.
And finally, we have Josh Berman, the label manager for Warp Records.
I'm Josh, label manager at Warp Records, which is an independent record label with artists like Grizzly Bear, Aphex Twin, Square Pusher, Flying Lotus, and I run all North American operations.
So to get this conversation started, it was interesting. I posed as a structural thing to launch by saying, well, you know, nowadays there's really no argument that branding artists is good, that the old-fashioned idea of selling out is sort of over. And I immediately actually got some pushback from the panel. So I just posed that as the question. Is the very idea of associating artists with brands at all problematic in the 21st century? Are there lingering problems, or are we in a brave new world where now those things coexist, art and commerce?
Josh?
I will say that we are in a brave new world where it is more bands, almost all bands, are very open to branding now. The term selling out is somewhat moot, although not completely. And as it pertains to Warp, we have a handful of our sort of most iconic, well-known artists who have never associated with a brand and will always refuse to. Well, not always, but I certainly don't see them changing anytime soon. And those artists include Autechre, Square Pusher, Aphex Twin, Boards of Canada. They've never had an endorsement from a brand, from a music instrument company, from anything. But on the flip side, we work with bands like Grizzly Bear and Flying Lotus who are very open to it, but it just really depends on the brand and how they're approaching it.
Yeah, and for Sub Pop, I'd say that most of our bands, large 99% of the bands are open. You know, it's always on a case-by-case basis. Everybody wants to make sure the brand works for them and the deal is right, but there are still some holdouts that are just like, no way, you know, this is my band. I don't want to be associated with anybody other than my band and how I want it to be seen.
I think from our point of view, we're often coming at it from, I suppose, the other side of the fence with that. And we've definitely, I think, when we develop ideas, so a lot of our ideas we've developed over the last several years, the bands that we've targeted and felt would be ideal to be a part of those most often been bands or artists that never do brand things, don't do brand things, hadn't done them before, and that's part of kind of who they are and what's always made them most interesting to us. And I think we've had cases where we've just had artists say, I'm just not comfortable with that. But we've definitely had cases where going to them and really explaining, hey, here's what we want to do here and here's what this is, and you're going to really have the freedom to do your art, do your music, create, and be a part of this. And we've brought that wall down, and we've done things with people for the first time. We just did something with James Murphy, Andre 3000, and the Gorillaz for Converse. James certainly hadn't done much of anything in the way of brand things before. An earlier version of that same Converse program featured Julian Casablancas, which was the first time he'd done anything from a brand standpoint. And I think we've had a lot of examples like that where we've made artists feel good about what it is we were creating, and they've been on board. But we've also certainly dealt with artists that just are flat out not comfortable with it.
Same here for us. We have artists that are super comfortable with reaching out to brands. They see themselves as a brand themselves. You know, they're on Twitter saying, this is who I am, this is my brand, you should embrace it. So it's just finding the right brand that makes sense with the artists. It aligns with their beliefs and what they want. We have artists that say no to alcohol. We just know not to approach anything with alcohol or tobacco. Certain car brands, we know not to do this. So it just depends on the artist.
So I was curious if each of you could talk about kind of a watershed moment when you felt like you first got it right, the relationship that we're talking about. So let's start with that. Like, was there, I mean, Jennifer, I'll go to you because you have a historic watershed moment, which you might want to describe.
Well, I wasn't there at the time, but I'm not familiar. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Sub Pop history, but the co-founders, Jonathan Poneman and Bruce Pavitt, had a novel concept, which was, we're not going to market a particular band, we're going to market the label, and then all of the bands will benefit from the association with the label. So, you know, somewhat ironically, we are one of the few labels that started out as a brand in and of its own right.
I was actually thinking of that other historic moment with the Shins.
Oh, right. That wasn't unintentional situation. I mean, I guess I kind of had an idea that something like that could happen, but I had no idea how big it would be. And that was when we got approached by Zach Braff to license the Shins for use in the Garden State movie. And, you know, they gave us the script and said, here's, you know, where we want to have Natalie Portman talk about how great the Shins are. And so, you know, we knew that it was going to be a big association, and you know, we were all about it, and it ended up, you know, we had sold about 70,000 Shins records at the point where Garden State came out, and after it came out, we, you know, have sold 500,000 or more, gone gold on every single record that they
really
put out.
It really became emblematic of that kind of licensing
opportunity. And in fact, it was funny because that did create some trouble for the band. I mean, not sort of trouble, but they, you know, New Slang became the song that they had to play at every show, and the Garden State fans all came to their shows, and so it was, you know, all of a sudden they had a whole new group of fans that were fans of the movie first, then became fans of the band, and so that song became very precious. And so the Shins have always been open to licensing, but after Garden State, they were, you know, they felt like they had to protect New Slang, and so they didn't do any New Slang licensing for quite a long time after that, because it had become so emblematic of Garden State.
I think our watershed moment, and I feel like there's been several, but I think the one that really stands out is the first time when we realized, like, wow, we can really do something that is really naturally integrated into the world in terms of how music fans get music, appreciate music, is when we did something for Nike for the 25th anniversary of the Air Force One. To celebrate that, we created an original piece of music. We brought together Nas, Kanye West, KRS-One, and Rakim, did two versions of that song, one produced by Rick Rubin, one remixed by DJ Premier, and we put that out and just distributed that for a little while, sold it on iTunes for charity, and then distributed it for free, and then built an entire campaign around that. And just the reaction from the artists in terms of the platform we gave them to come together and create and meet each other, because they were all artists who hadn't done that before, to the reaction from consumers to this day, to music fans that bring that up. It was the first and only brand-created song to be nominated for a Grammy, and I think just the whole process of seeing that thing come to life really opened our eyes and helped inspire some of the things that we're doing now. And, you know, the realization that, like, we can use the platform that brands are to create something great that wouldn't exist without us and put that out there.
Well, before we move on, I just want to ask you, Jeff, were there any like bumps in that road? Because there's a lot of, to just add cliche upon cliche, there are a lot of moving parts in that, too. I mean, there's not only the brand, Nike, but also the whole military aspect of the Air Force One side, and then you're working with all these different artists,
right.
So... How did
I think in terms of the openness of the artist to be a part of the Air Force One, I think that brand holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts, and especially the artist that we were talking to. So I think we identified who we wanted to work with, one, to tell a little bit of a story about what the history of the Air Force One was, but two, artists that really are passionate about it and love it. And we essentially, like, when working with them on creating the record, almost begged them not to talk about it because we didn't want this to be a commercial or sound like a commercial. And like it still ended up in Rakim's verse. It was great, so we left it. Nas's first verse was about Phil Knight. And then we scrapped that. But it was it was great, but only because it's not what we wanted to do. So I think artists in that case were open arms for excited about it. You know, we obviously, the logistics obviously create their own bumps. You know, getting all those labels they're all on major labels for the most part, getting them all to approve it, dealing with all the various publishers. Like, there's back-end logistics, getting the artist to, you know, feel good about the same track. You know, there was back-end logistics that are certainly, like, bumps were endless. But, but ultimately, like, you know, it worked out well. And the artists, as far as wanting to be a part of it, were passionate about it.
Well, there had been precedent in hip-hop, obviously, with My Adidas also. Like, that kind of branding. And Jasmine, in your world, I mean, products are part of the lingo from the beginning.
Absolutely. It's you sit down and you think, okay, this is the artist. What are the brands that associates with this artist? And you think, how can we make it part of our marketing plan?
Right.
How can we integrate something? So you have to make sure it's the right brand. Just thinking of charity with the Killers, every year they've done a Christmas single that's for charity. They're partnered with Red. It's a great cause that, you know, the Killers, they feel. So every year, and each year, last year was with Starbucks. It was a free download. Also the video for free, and it was however many views the video got, Starbucks donated a percentage of that many views for charity. So it's something that it has to be a brand and a charity that the artist is passionate about in order to work and make it organic rather than feel forced that, oh, the label's forcing Adidas on us and that doesn't go with us. So,
Yeah. And Josh, you were saying that a lot of your artists aren't into this, but I know we were talking about the Black Keys before. I don't know if that was a watershed moment for you.
Well, I mean, that was interesting. I used to work at Nonesuch Records, and when we signed the Black Keys, it was just a really interesting moment because, you know, we don't really sit down and think brand integration when we're talking about planning a record. We didn't at Nonesuch, and we certainly don't at Warp. Like I said, it's very few of our artists have access to the brands or want to associate with them. But the Black Keys told the story where they were approached by Mayonnaise Company and turned it down because they didn't want to be known as the Mayonnaise Band. And another, you know, sort of, not rival band, but a peer of theirs got the commercial, and it was a huge amount of money. And they saw that there was very little flack from that other band taking that, so they basically said, well, we're never going to say no again. But they're one of the very few bands that can get away with that. We were talking about Snoop Dogg playing in the giant Doritos thing. No, that's not going to hurt him at all. But if other bands who really need to kind of keep the cool and were associated with something like that, that might actually hurt their core audience and it might affect them negatively. Like I said, a lot of times grabbing at a big short-term gain can actually hurt you long-term. So we think about that a lot with our artists.
I just reminded me of something with, you know, with the... When we did brought KRS-One in, I think historically he's someone who you would think would be very anti-brand.
Right.
And that was the one that we had some question marks about. And he had a great experience. He ended up doing another brand thing with us after. And I think what was interesting, like, that just reminded me of, he did a press conference before an event for that other event thing. And someone asked him about the corporatization of hip-hop and how he felt about that now being a part of that. And he said, it's not about the corporatization of hip-hop, it's about the hip-hopization of corporate America. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, and I think for him, he saw, like, in terms of where that genre's gone over the years and kind of how that's flipped, I think he saw it as just as progress for hip-hop.
Well, that's very interesting. It makes me think about even Chuck D and his philosophy of black-owned businesses and stuff. It's not like music, and Jen, you were saying before also, I mean, we've always had product placement, whether it was musical instruments back in the day,
right,
or endorsing
right.
Fender or something
right,
like that.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You know, and even before, I mean, even when it wasn't official, artists would say wear a kind of jeans or have a certain thing that emblematized them. They just weren't necessarily profiting from it. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, in the case of the musical instruments, they were, but of course it always comes with strings attached, like you were talking about, you know.
Yeah.
You do a certain kind of, you know, got a certain kind of brand, well then you can't, you know, appear on any live show or anything using anything other than their equipment. So
right.
You have to be aware of your surroundings whenever you're doing a performance. It's like, oh wait, it has that logo, we got to cover it up, and that's
right.
It's just something that comes with the territory that you just have to embrace it, because you are getting that check that helps you at the end of the day. So
well, what have you had, like, Jasmine, have there been issues where you've run into limitations? Are your artists ever felt limited by an association with a brand?
The only case I can think of is we were approached by an energy drink for one of our artists, and at the time it seemed perfect because they were providing the tour bus, they were providing tour support, which is great. They were driving a really bad van, so a tour bus seems a while, of course, what a no-brainer. And then down the line, so they signed a deal, and down the line, another energy drink came. And it's like, oh, we can't do anything because we're already signed with this one.
I see.
So that was the only thing time I can think of.
So that was really about choosing one
over
product over another.
But at the time, it was the right time. It was perfect. So you go with it. So, yeah.
So what about, and I'm just like being a little devil's advocate here, but have you, any of you ever had like a mayonnaise band? Or has for you, Jeff, a product, you know, been associated with an artist that then ultimately that association doesn't pan out, doesn't feel right?
I feel like those fears are a little bit exaggerated. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think your case points to that. The band is, you know, if they're a popular band or if people love their music, just because they associate with a product doesn't mean that they're going to become that product.
Right.
And they're always going to still retain their individual identity, but the band has to be able to own it. They have to feel good about it, or else, you know, the criticism will always hit them very hard, and they won't, you know, it won't be a comfortable place for them to be.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, not in our case. I mean, I think I've seen bad artist-brand relationships. I've seen those relationships executed badly. I see ones that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I can't attach any of those to ours. You know, and I think the type of company we are is pretty different, and I think we come from a place that is music first, so I think it puts us in an interesting position to make that right connection and make it feel right for an artist. You know, I think in terms of restricting an artist, I mean, I think we'll deal with artists sometimes on a brand relationship that there's certain artists that all this is out the window, and it's about who's going to write me the biggest check. So if you're talking to me about something for Pepsi,
right,
well, what if Coke's going to come next week and offer me this? And that's typically not an artist we want to work with.
Right.
But we're in cases sometimes where what we're doing warrants that. You know, I think a lot of times for us, it's the artists, or it's more about how do we create the right avenues for the artists, let them have freedom in terms of what we want to do, with obviously, you know, the restrictions that might come into some of the, you know, like we do a platform for Mountain Dew called Green Label Sound,
right,
which is essentially a record label, you know, where we distribute music for free, and we really look at it as a platform to, you know, set these artists up and support them in a way that they wouldn't be able to be supported otherwise. And even with artists that are already on labels at times, I think we're able to provide resources, more resources that ultimately benefit the label that they're on. We were talking about that a bit earlier. And I think, you know, with that, obviously sometimes there can be some parameters around what they record. Like, we do have to be conscious that we shouldn't be, you know, using a lot of cursing, a lot of, you know, weird subject matter. But I think, you know, even if you were to listen to the last three artists, one song track we did for Converse with Andre 3000 and James and Gorillaz, you know, there's some, we're toeing the line, there's some interesting topic there. And I think, you know, some brands will get comfortable with that, but obviously even in that case, we had to just, like, let them know in front, like, let's keep this in a nice place.
Well, this is bringing us to the place of, like, okay, the other element in this triangle is the audience or the consumer, right? And I guess the general question I would ask is, how do you figure out that what consumer that is for whom they're both a consumer of the artist's work and of the product? Like, because there are many different kinds of consumers.
Yeah. Well, what we try to do is, you know, we really only say, or our artists really only say yes, or we only try to align our artists with brands when we know that there's a track record of those brands not overreaching and not forcing, you know, whatever it is they're trying to do down our throats. So we work with Converse a lot because they're really open-minded and they just want to support the artist. There's things along those lines that are very important. And also, you know, our artists like wearing Converse. So,
yeah,
you know.
Right. Right, it's like Levi's or something like that, yeah.
Right, and especially with a lot of our electronic music artists, you know, if they're using Ableton or Serato or Logic or any of these software programs and we get approached by them, it's a no-brainer. If they want to help us out, that's great. We're already using the product. And a lot of times those companies don't have the same exclusivity clauses as some of these other music instrument companies. So just because the way that the music is created, they're using 15 different objects on stage. You can't have exclusivity because Ableton doesn't make the MPC. They don't make the keyboard, so there's no problems there.
Right.
I think we've definitely developed. Sometimes we look, you know, looking at it from the brand standpoint first. A lot of times we're saying, like, what is it we want to build for this brand? Like, what do we want this brand to stand for? And then you select artists that feel right for that. So, you know, starting from there, like when I think about when we started Green Label Sound with Mountain Dew, who hadn't done a lot in the music space at that point, or at least a lot that had been that well executed. It wasn't, you know, we essentially, when we first started talking to artists about this concept, there was a lot of hesitation, you know, a lot of it, just because it hadn't been done before. You know, it's just not something they felt comfortable with,
they
putting their music out.
They weren't into Mountain Dew?
Well, it was less, I think, the product association. There was a little bit of that, but I think it was, I'm going to put my music out through a soda.
Yeah.
And what this is, and I think, you know, we finally, the Cool Kids were our first artist, Matt and Kim was our second artist. And once the music community saw how that worked, you know, how that went well for them, the walls came down, and now we have artists we're 3 years into this now, but who come to us and want to be a part of it because they feel really comfortable with it. They're seeing people they respect do it.
Right.
And, you know, and I think so we'll have cases like that. Or, you know, we do spirits is a really interesting category at times because that is one which some artists don't feel it's morally right to be a part of, or there could be other things. And we do a campaign for the whiskey brand Bushmills. You know, and a part of that campaign, we have a lot of different people from different walks of life. It's actually not just music, but Bon Iver is one of the bands it's a big part of that campaign, and they hadn't done brand things before and certainly were hesitant to be a part of a brand. And I think what it came down to ultimately was they loved everything we were doing around the brand, number one. Number two, they actually loved the brand. It was on their rider. It has been on their rider for years. Justin Vernon's dad is a massive Irish whiskey collector. It's the most amazing collection you've ever seen and is very proud of it, and was also a managing editor of a really well-regarded book on Irish whiskeys.
Wow.
So there was like a real history there, and I think because of all of that, you know, he felt really good about doing it. And I think there have been some little nips at him since it's launched, you'll see on some blogs, there was like there's some things that will come up that I'm sure make him a little uncomfortable or make them a little uncomfortable. But overall, they've been so supportive of it and happy of it. And when asked questions on it, have just said, like, look, I love whiskey. I love what we're celebrating here and what we're talking about. And ultimately, they feel good about it. But I think that category can be weird. And we've definitely had artists that say, I will not touch spirits.
So I just have to ask, like, how did you know that Justin Vernon was into Bushmills? Like, that is such a series of surprising events. We did know
that it had been on his rider in the past, just from some other, you know, work and other things. But ultimately, we landed on that band because of what we were creating as a campaign, the story of how Justin works with his friends and all these things that really tied well into our campaign.
Because it was certainly like the craftiness
the Grammys
of the whiskey,
and
you're emphasizing that.
Exactly,
like
the campaign.
Artisanal tradition. The campaign
is kind of about friends who work together to create culture that ultimately shapes the world. Bushmills is a 400-year-old distillery in the town of Bushmills, and it's kind of got that similar ethos. So we've built this whole campaign around that from all sorts of different artists. So we just felt like he was perfect, and he was the perfect. So we went after him and didn't really have a great expectation that he'd be interested in, but ultimately he was interested.
Well, I think that's kind of one of the themes that you'll hear, is that it really has to be a match between artist and product. You know, the artist has to be able to say, I believe in this product, I think what they're doing is great, and the product has to be able to say, I believe in what this artist is doing, we like their music, we like their vision or their message. So I think that's really one of the keys to having a very successful branding opportunity, is that both sides are, believing in the other.
What's the detail work, though, that goes, what Jeff was just talking about, really laid down the detail work of figuring out that match. Can any of you from the other side share a story that offers that detail work of how you know an artist and a product? I mean, are you, scrutinizing? Your artist walks in, you're like, okay, I see that the shoes are that, and I smell this cologne.
For me, when I meet with my artists, most of the time, if it's a brand new artist, first time I'm meeting them, I sit down and say, what brands do you like?
Oh, you just ask them directly,
right away. What do you want to work with? What brand do you want? We have this rock band, or Mona. They all wear Ray-Bans. So clearly, Ray-Bans is a great, now they're doing music things. They want to be associated with music artists, so it's clear. They all wear All Saints. That's all they're dressed with. Levi jeans, it's right. Like that. You sit down and you figure it out. Another thing is when it's a specific campaign, I have a band right now, My Darkest Days, their single's called Casual Sex. Trojans come to mind. So it's basically you come with something that works with the campaign. So right. That's how we figure it out.
Either of you on the end have a story of the detail work you've done to associate an artist with a product?
For us, more so, it's more about how the brand actually integrates with us.
With you as a label, or?
Well, with the artist. So Red Bull Music Academy is sort of associated with the brand of Red Bull, and we work with them constantly. This is one of our kind of watershed moments was, they kind of helped launch the career of Flying Lotus, mm-hmm. and artists like Jeremiah J, who we just signed, who's a graduate of Red Bull Music Academy, and guys like Rusty. So they really help us out. Again, like what you do with the Rubber Tracks Recording Studio in Brooklyn, it's about supporting the artist. And while, yes, you're lending your name to it, it's also, it's not just a purely branding thing. It's not, here's some money, let's
right.
talk. It's about how do we help the artist, how do we support the artist. So it's more, we look for brands more like that than saying, oh, well, you wear this kind of shoe, so let's go after that.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Red Bull Music Academy, because, they're doing amazing things with almost like a music education and helping artists learn their own craft, and the Converse Rubber Tracks is, it's really like making it possible for certain artists to create music. And this brings up the fact that with the conventional music industry falling apart, there's a lot of gaps to be filled. There's a lot of, sorry anyone out there that hurts, but brands are other kinds of corporations, companies, I'm always saying corporations, are stepping into the gap and filling those gaps. And even to the point where physical distribution of music mm-hmm. is not a factor. So nowadays, for me as a journalist, if I actually remember when that first Mountain Dew music started happening, I was like, oh, what is this, a jingle or something? But now it almost slips by me what... Mm-hmm. What package holds the music?
You're not as cynical or not thinking that it's a strange association anymore.
But of course, someone who is maybe a no logo type person, or Naomi Klein wrote that book No Logo, like a person who does not like brands would say, but that's insidious. It's seeping into our consciousness mm-hmm. through these ways. So I guess this brings up the question of the ethics of how brands and other kinds of extra musical products are now such a dominant force in the distribution and creation of music.
Well, I feel like, to some degree there is this sort of brand creep. I kind of, think of it in those terms, because it seems like, everybody wants a little bit more, okay, we're going to license a song for a TV show. Well, oh, now they want to stream it on their website, or now they want a picture of the artist with their bio, too. And
right.
little by little, they're just kind of like, oh, it's just promotion, it's good for you, it's good. But I think I see, more and more companies feeling like that association with the artist is going to benefit them. And I just always want to make sure that the artists are getting a fair deal out of it, because they, those companies, those products really are getting huge benefit by the association with these artists and their fans look up to the artists and, will take their lead if they think that band is in favor of a product.
What are the basic ingredients of a fair deal? Is number one, ownership of the music. I know we were talking about that with Converse, that the artist owns the music.
Yeah, well, in the case of the Rubber Tracks example, it's a recording studio where we give away free recording time. And we do it through through Converse.com. You can register, you can sign up. We're actually we took over a couple studios here in Austin for the weekend. We've let a couple local bands that registered. We kind of recreated it down here. We have some bands from town recording that you know are not necessarily in town for South by Southwest, but are bands in Austin looking for that opportunity. So we're doing that here, and we do it in Brooklyn. At Rubber Tracks, which is a facility that has a beautiful, beautiful studio. We have a live space. We have a rehearsal room that we also, all of it is for free. And we give, we've got, top-of-the-line engineers. And bands that come in and use that space and want to use that space, we give them the option. If we might be doing some content that day, there are different days we do content, they can be a part of it, they can say no. If they want us to stream the music they record on Converse's Facebook and through some of their channels and take advantage of the 40 million plus Facebook fans that Converse has, they can. But they can also say no. They can walk out of there with their music and give us none. There never would be a case where we ask for ownership. Sometimes we ask them if they'd like us to stream it or if we can have the rights to stream it or something along those lines. If they say no, that's fine. So there's nothing really asked of the artists that come in there. And I think in all the cases where we've created original music, Green Label Sound, all the Converse, even the Air Force One, we've never asked for ownership of any of that music. So we've always structured the deals that the artists and or rights holders of that music retain all ownership. We just carve out the deal, so obviously we have our window to use it as we want to. And I think those songs have gone on to be sold by the respective labels and things along those lines, and we've never asked for ownership of anything.
In that case, it's really what Converse is, the association isn't even with particular artists, it's with the fact of, the entity of a recording studio, that it's...
Yeah, I think Rubber Tracks is almost in its own category that way, because it's really just come and use our space and enjoy it, and it's a really amazing opportunity, I think. We do some other things in there. We do some shows in there once in a while and some other things where we do stuff. But it's all about really creative. From a Converse perspective, it's really about, Converse is such an anomaly of a brand. And I think the way they realize they don't really have to market themselves. They've been a part of this culture for a long time. And I think for them, it's about just creating the relationship, keeping the relationship strong, and giving back to the community that's really ultimately made them who they are as a brand. And that's what that space is about. It's about giving people an experience of a lifetime. We create great relationships with all the bands that have been in there. They get a day typically, but we always bring them back, let them work in Studio B and finish mixing. Our engineers will end up working on their mixes for them after the fact. Like, we've had some great relationships built with bands that, are not currently in a position to be on a record label, have day jobs, things along those lines, mm-hmm. but are looking for those opportunities.
And if they're wearing Vans, you're not mad at them. Like, that's cool.
No, they can wear whatever they want. They all do get Converse for a free pair when they're there, which I think is a nice part of the experience, but they don't have to wear them.
Well, I think Jeff has pointed out some of the more favorable branding opportunities, but I would say that the bulk of the branding opportunities, it seems like the initial deals that they're offering the artists are not that favorable to the artists.
Right.
So in general, I would say at least half of the opportunities that come our way end up not happening because, there's too much being asked of the artist and not enough either, money or music or whatever, whatever it is giving back to the artist. So, there's some companies like maybe a mobile phone company, they want to tape a live show and they want to own it and they want to stream it. And, they're not necessarily offering ownership or money or anything. They're just like, we're going to put it out there. It's going to be great for you. We get a million views a day or whatever, whatever it is. So I'm a little bit more, cynical. It seems like, you're talking about some great opportunities, but I'd say a lot of them, the companies are looking for the biggest bang for a little buck that they can get from the artists.
I find, and I love record labels. We even have them. but I do find sometimes that some labels, and some labels are notorious for this, and particularly get in the way of where artists really want to do something, like maybe one of the programs I'm talking about. And if there's content involved or something like that, that the labels get in the way and say no to it, and they feel strongly that it's not something they should do as a label or an artist, which is, they're right and fine. But I do find, and you're absolutely right, there are horrible opportunities brought to artists,
yeah.
And you know, but there is also, I think, at times labels, from my point of view, sometimes are really overly protective of things that they really shouldn't be that protective of, you know. I think at times, you know, I think there's definitely cases.
Well, I would say that some of, I agree with you, and some labels. It just depends on the situation. But there's opportunity costs associated with anything.
Right.
So you know, the label has certain marketing strategy, and if they're needing the artists to do interviews and radio station shows and things like that, but the product, the brand, wants them to do their own interviews and their own shows and take their time. You know, sometimes that really can conflict with the message that the record label is trying to get out on behalf of the artist. So, you know, it has to be figured out what the brand wants and what the label needs for the artist, if they align. So there's definitely the...
Well, it sounds like you can get to a point where who is the artist working for, the label or the brand, but then on the other hand, they're working for themselves, ultimately.
And it depends on the reach of what the brand wants. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Some deals, you know, they want interviews, and they want a music video, and they want a single, and they want, you know, all this kind of stuff. They want to film the band in the studio and do stuff.
Right.
And so all of that exposure can be good, but it could also maybe conflict with the message that the record label wants.
Yeah, I think, where I find the biggest resistance at times with certain labels have just flat-out policies that their artists are not going to be in video content. Their artists for a brand. Their artists are not, or without an outrageous fee.
Huh.
Or they're not going to be, you know, and I think sometimes, from my point of view, where things get blocked, maybe unnecessarily, is just this blatant, this outright holding on to, this doesn't happen without, you know, whether it's certain compensation or this just flat out doesn't happen on things that ultimately probably are actually good for the artist, and situations that like the ones I'm describing that would be good for the artist. So I think, you know, we do see a little bit of both, where it's almost archaic, I suppose, where artists are like labels are still stuck in like what record labels were.
This is
my new way to make, you know, I think there's at times there's challenges, I think, with people saying like, all right, let me embrace the new world and take advantage of it.
Right. Well, it's kind of like labels not wanting to have their music downloaded on iTunes for a while or something, where it's just like, this is our policy. We're not doing it.
Right. Josh, holding out for that kind of thing obviously didn't work that well.
Josh, you're being very quiet over there.
I mean, I think that Warp is very guilty of exactly what you're talking about. We are so protective of our brand, but it's worked for us for 23 years, and there is this... but the thing is, we've actually been able to walk that line now, specifically over the last 5 years, because we have bands like Grizzly Bear and Jamie Lydell and Flying Lotus and Maximo Park, who were well up for stuff, as long as it, you know, made sense with all the things we've talked about. But you know, Warp Records is a brand, and we are fiercely protective of that. So I'm sure we've, you know, pissed your guys off a few times.
It's totally respected, and I think like XL is another example of that.
Right.
Like, it's always like we've got a great idea for a band, and it's like, oh man, they're on XL.
Right.
And then because have all the respect in the world for Warp and XL and what they built around their artist. But I think, you know, there are instances where we know the artist is into it, and it seems probably like it'd be good. And let's find a compromise here.
Yeah.
Well, I'm always willing to have the conversation, but more times than not, it ends in a no. So.
But this is interesting that you bring up XL, because I think of XL as associated with a certain kind of politics. We'll have questions in a little bit. Also, you know, progressive politics, that no logo way of looking at the world that I mentioned. And I wondered how often you ran it. I mean, you know, popular music is a, especially rock and roll. I would say in hip hop it's complicated. In the KRS-One example was very interesting, because he's another one I would have thought would take a lot of persuasion. But, you know, aside from like financial benefit to the artist, this idea of I just don't want to be one of those people who's adding to the massive numbers of products and brands out there. And how often did all of you face that coming from both artists and labels, I would think, if ever? Silence. Nobody wants to admit it. Like I was saying with XL, like, you know, I mean, Tom York put out his solo album on the XL. That is a guy I cannot imagine. I don't even know if he buys anything but recycled clothes that he knits himself, you know?
He's not gonna do a brand. Nor should he.
Yeah, right.
Right, and that's kind of like the way that Warp has established itself as well, is we've historically done that, and if we all of a sudden flipped a switch and started doing all these things, we would lose our core audience. So that's why we're very careful with what we do.
And yet there is this notion of conscientious consumerism, and that certain products are different than certain others. And I know, Jasmine, you and I had talked a little bit about this, and maybe you can give us some examples, aside from the general example of, like, no alcohol, like how an artist might, like, say with clothing. I mean, there's certain brands that are very high-end that for an artist to associate with it might be almost a burden on their fans, because now they have to buy the very expensive thing, or the knockoff on Canal Street, which works. But
I mean, yeah, that's definitely, you know, you see Rihanna wearing Gucci, Prada, all these things that her fans obviously cannot afford, but that's just her lifestyle, and she's not necessarily endorsing that as a brand that she is saying, you guys have to go buy this. That's just necessarily her style. But I do see the point where it's, you have to be conscious of your fans and what they're buying. For the most part, for us, it's just a lifestyle. We know that the fans will embrace it. We know that that's what the artist embraces, so it kind of goes hand in hand together, so...
And then there are products that are just uncool.
Right, of course.
Yeah, they're just straight up.
I mean, how do you make an uncool thing cool? Like, how would you
lots and lots of money. I'm just kidding. Well, sort of. Only sort of.
Well, there's definitely bands that are uncool.
Yeah,
in that way that will, like, work with all those products.
Right,
and
right.
And that's, like, not attractive to, I think, a lot of fans or other brands,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
So it's just all about matchmaking and getting the right...
It's so much a process. You know, every case has its own trajectory, and it's just never an easy, like, oh, here's so-and-so artist and so-and-so brand, and let's make this great marketing campaign, and it all comes together, you know, so naturally. I mean, I think that's very rare. I think what really happens is, you know, somebody gets an idea, and it maybe clicks, maybe doesn't, and, you know, what do you think? Like, out of those ideas that you have, 1 out of 10 maybe get some traction? Or, I mean... How many do you think as a percentage actually come to fruition?
All the good ones. I think honestly it's never we've never
But you don't know until you get into it.
We've never had an idea that involved an artist that completely got stalled because, like, artists flat out wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, we've had artists say no, or our top choice say no, or something along those lines. But we've never had an idea flat out stall.
Mm-hmm.
We've certainly had ideas evolve because an artist has a lot of input and mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Right.
But
they're like, I'll do this, but not that.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, at this point, when we're doing something along these lines for a brand, we are always coming at it from, how are we going to support an artist? How are we going to create a relationship that's going to benefit the consumer, the artist, you know, whomever, and it's pretty much, you know, what we've tried to stay true to. So, you know, we've always been able to find willing participants that we like as well.
Right, right.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Let's have some questions from the audience. I know you had your hand up like 10 minutes ago, so you can go first. Speak loudly, and we've got a mic. Okay, super. You're going to walk it around.
Thank you. I'll try to remember what I was going to say.
it's been way too long. Yeah.
Well, you know, I work for a company that tries to help musicians connect with the charity and the things that they care about and bring them along with their career. But it's interesting in this discussion about brand, because there's really a bunch of brands at play. There's the artist's brand as well, and a lot of times they shy away from that term, like selling out, you know, or there's something... impure about being strategic about your brand, but the examples you're showing, I think, support the idea that, you know, they need to define their brand very carefully and recognize, you know, what are their priorities and how do they define themselves. You know, I've worked for the largest nonprofit in the world for the last 4 years, helping product manufacturers understand that, you know, there's a new definition of quality now, whether it's through, you know, federal legislation, the consumer demand, your competition, the global marketplace. Quality is not what it was before, and it now includes a bunch of other stuff at the bottom of that list that you better have good answers for, and they better be authentic, and it better be real, and it better be transparent. So this is kind of a long-ass intro into the question. The question is, to what degree do you advocate those artists, for those of you who work with music and talent from the beginning, to what degree do you advocate that they define their characteristics, their value systems ahead of time, and know that really well so that they can be on the lookout for that stuff? Because, you know, you get to do it, you get to define it by whatever terms you want, but being consistent with that, I would think, would be really critical for an artist, because if you look totally, you know, hypocritical, you know, a year later or moments after you've, you know, made some big investment with something, like, it can, I would think, super backfire.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's more than one, it's an ongoing conversation. Yeah. It's a constant, with every artist it's completely different. So, and there are some artists who are, you know, very vocal. They wear their hearts on their sleeve. They're constantly saying stuff on social media that they probably shouldn't. But it just depends on the artist. But it's not a one conversation where you sit them down and you say, what is your brand? What are you after? It's every time you're approached, or even when you just have an idea, it's making sure that they're on board and why they are or aren't. And a lot of times it's also knowing exactly what the brand wants. If they don't know what they want, they just want to give you some money to associate with something cool. And there's no driver there, then it's also an issue. So it's a constant conversation with the artist about their own brand, and then when they're approached, it's finding out on the other side of things what the brand actually wants out of the partnership.
And they're evolving, you know, they're just like you and me. So one day they're going to feel strongly about one thing, and the next day they might not, because they might find, you know, so whether it's charity or a brand, they're going to evolve, they're going to change their minds. So you just have to keep the constant contact as to if they agree with the product, they agree with the charity, how they feel about it, and it just evolves from there.
Absolutely,
I would definitely, you know, have the conversation at a moment where somebody's asking, you know, that they want this artist to, you know, appear in this kind of branding opportunity. And I really see there's like a big, you know, a line. There's like the very extreme versus the sort of mild. And if they're going to go something in the extreme, like extreme association, then it's like, yeah, let's dig a little bit deeper into this company and find out.
Right.
And I would definitely advise them to do that. I wouldn't necessarily do it for them, but I would talk to their manager and or them and make sure that they're, you know, considering these things when they.
Before we move on, specifically in relation to that question, which I thank you for asking, how many concerns about like whether products are green, and also particularly with food products and even sodas, healthiness? Like, are those things that you talk about with the artists you're working with?
Absolutely, a lot of our artists are definitely concerned about the environment and energy issues. So, you know, an oil company wanting to use a song in a commercial is just, I don't know any artists are going to say okay to that. You know, that's just...
But they will say okay to car commercials.
They might, yeah, if they like the car. Or maybe, you know, or maybe it has to be a green car, you know, some kind of a hybrid or something like that. So they're, you know, they're just variations. Mm-hmm. And as far as food goes, the healthy thing, I'm not sure if, you know, if it's as important. I mean, because some artists, you know, they love their fast food, and so they're totally cool with it, and they make no apologies. So, you know,
they're out on the road, and Taco Bell's the only thing to eat. They're not going to say no if you don't have anything else, so it's not us.
But a lot of artists I work with do eat Taco Bell on the road, but will refuse to admit to that. Or it's not about admitting it. They'll refuse to lend their music to Taco Bell. So there's sort of a balance there as well.
My question is for a smaller group, let's say a band that has toured four or five times nationally, all indie, is looking for the opportunities to connect with companies, or just the opportunity to connect to, of course, extend your fan base through other companies that are trying to do what we're doing, which is expand their business. Mm-hmm. How would you recommend someone like myself, who manages the band, going and... not necessarily going after the different companies that would fit and be authentic, but what would be the key points of value that we would offer as not a huge band, you know, a band that's really working hard, can spread the word through the stage, of course, and then the interaction with the fans or the places that we stay, things like that. But what would be some recommendations as far as branding with a smaller band?
There was two things about that. One is I've seen over time bands like you're describing reach out directly to brands, like get the right person's ear or something, and just say, I'm a huge fan of your brand. I use it. I love it. I do this. I'd love to just, you know, figure out how to do something along those lines, and that'll get that particular brand manager or somebody really excited, and they'll say, you know, let's figure something out with these guys. Let's support them in some way. I've seen that happen numerous times. The other thing that I think is really interesting is I think a lot of the conversation we're even having right now only exists because of social media and everything mm-hmm. else. Because before these platforms, I think it was really hard to get the bigger brands to really work with an artist in this capacity in any way that wasn't just working with a massive pop star type mm-hmm. of artist mm-hmm. because they had the vehicles. They were on radio, they were on TV, they were in all those things. But now brands have really embraced the indie community. In that type of artist who might not ever be on the radio or mainstream radio or, you know, and TV for that matter, but has an audience, has sites that religiously report what they do, or has a big Twitter following and a big Facebook following. So they're trusting that these guys are going to communicate to people and have avenues to now communicate to those people. So it makes sense for me to partner with them. And I think a band that's got, you know, maybe even a slightly smaller audience than that, or a much smaller audience than that, but still has people that pay attention and is working to build it up, I think now has probably a better opportunity than ever to get a brand to pay attention because you have those avenues.
Mm-hmm. Just to give you an example, I consider myself a brand, not that I have a billion Twitter followers or anything, but I Twittered the other day that I love these chocolate chip cookies. The company reached out to me and was like, oh, what's your address? I'll send you a gift basket. And they did. And it just, and they're like, oh, you work in music. How can we work together? How can we help with your artist? It's one of those things that through Twitter, Facebook, you know, you have, you know, it's a limit, you know, you don't have a limit. You can just keep going, and something that you're passionate about, you can reach out to somebody that's going to eventually get the person that you need to talk to you and be able to help you out. So
I wonder if you could address the issue of local brands versus national, international. Like, is there opportunities for grassroots starting artists with local companies, and how would that work?
And just really quickly, just branding wise, something that I've found that has been really effective, many musicians who are in the state with good
music and beers are like, there you go. There's one
right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I'm from Michigan, so Bell's short.
With local bands, local Michigan bands, you're talking about branding with Michigan beers.
Michigan breweries.
Right.
Are the audiences are one and the same.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it makes sense for them to promote the show. They do all the promotion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They put an extra special beer on tap. They call it the funk beer. You come in and turns into a much bigger event, which mm-hmm. on Facebook and everything. But some of the local businesses don't have, here's the local thing, and this is where I found struggles. They don't have a desire. They don't.
The local companies that you think you could create a connection with, they don't necessarily, and even a brewery that wants to stay in state, they have no initiative or anything that they're going to gain from sponsoring a national tour and gaining exposure right. nationally. Same thing with local stores that are on the strip in 150,000 person town is, how do you connect with those brands that are below Converse? What are those brands?
Right.
It's, I guess, I have no problem going after it and being persistent, right. but what's been tough is figuring out what our value is for them, and I mean,
well, you probably have to come up maybe with the marketing idea. Yeah. In order to get listened to. Probably.
Yeah, and I think your value is, here's our audience, here's how many shows we're going to play in your town or in your state, here's the people that are going to come to those shows, obviously, here's how we can communicate what your brand is and integrate it into those shows. I think just laying it out for them that way.
Yeah, here's what we need from you in exchange, you know, to make it happen.
I was going to say, a lot of companies really love analytics, too. If you have geo-targeted things showing, well, we had, you know, 100 people download the single in this town, and they've never played there, so we're going to come there and do a big thing there. So if you have any of that, like, wonky data, that helps, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can draw this many amount of people to come to your local bar to specifically taste your beer. So these are people that necessarily might not have been there already, but you can bring them, then that opens the
right.
door.
Yeah. I was just wondering if there's any tools or websites other than social media and other than directly contacting these brands for bands to connect with these brands. Do you guys have any suggestions?
Well, probably some companies like yours, right, Jeff? I mean...
Yeah. I mean, I know as far as just an existing tool, I'm not really sure if there is one. I mean, I'll throw out, obviously, Converse.com for rubber tracks. Yeah, I think there's places to be discovered and go talk to brands. But as far as just, like, maybe looking for a tool that gives you, like, here's who to talk to and here's how I talk to them, I don't know if one exists, you know, in terms of giving you that contact info and that kind of access.
So no matchmaker websites or anything like that?
There may be, but not that I'm aware of.
I would say South by Southwest is probably the best tool.
Yeah.
Look at your guide.
Right.
Yeah.
You guys just YouTube it.
I'll give you my business card. We really don't know each other, but you teed that up really well. I work for a marketing firm, but last year we spun off a platform called OneBandOneBrand.com where we pair emerging musicians with emerging fashion labels. And so downstairs...
Did you set that up?
That's why I just said it. Like, that was... Like, here's the money for that.
That's a plan.
Yeah. you should go downstairs and anyone else interested in that and check out Style By, which is the style component fashion for South by Southwest, and this is its second year. And there's a lot of emerging brands who are interested in doing those kinds of things. There's a sunglasses brand down there that has a bunch of little cards on the table with the bands that they work with, and they're doing it in a really cool way. But I wondered if you guys have any examples of sort of doing this kind of innovative stuff around merch specifically. And you said, you know, taking advantage of the live shows, and I just haven't seen a lot of innovative things. If you think about some of these bands, I mean, they're basically like a pop-up shop going around the country with this merch table, and I think that's an opportunity.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think from a brand standpoint, well, there's one thing that I can't talk about, but that we have we've been really looking into seriously with a brand, which I think could play really well into that and really be about. It would be a platform to give some bands who don't typically have serious merch to sell at their shows to provide them some merch. I think in other cases we've done some things like with Green Label Sound where, you know, we'll create limited edition vinyls and things like that that ultimately we'll hand to the bands to sell at shows and things along those lines. But we haven't done a ton of it. I don't know if you guys have.
Well, we did some Nike high tops with the Sub Pop logo. Some things like that where we can, you know, associate, or I'm sure Converse does things.
Well, we just did.
We put the, you know, different people's names on there.
We did the Big Boy Converse.
We did the Big Boy one, and we just did as part of that, the Gorillas I was just talking about, we just created a line. But that's not necessarily merch that they're selling on tour. That's something that's, you know, it's the new line of Chucks that are at retail. But it's not directly merch by any means.
And that can happen at a smaller level. Is it called Hex? The bags, they're like a skate and bag company out of San Francisco. They did a Far East Movement design pack that, you know, so it's not always just the giant brands that do that as well.
Uh-huh. I run a strategic partnership branding firm, and I thought it was kind of interesting because we have a lot of rock clients that are a little bit reluctant to take on branding if it just doesn't fit. But our country artists, though, on the other hand, have a mentality like, bring it on, because they look at more from a not perspective of like, oh, it's going to be about am I legit or whatever. They look at it more about, what is my audience like? If my audience likes State Farm Insurance, bring them on. If they like, you know, Jack Daniels, bring it on. So I kind of wanted your take on this kind of NASCAR mentality that country has, but it doesn't affect the band. They still, you know, why have an artist, Jason Aldean, who packs arenas? But what he does is his mentality is like, I'll take on certain brands, and he's not going to be ridiculous about some things, but he'll take himself, because what he can do now is turn around and pass that, the money he makes off that, even though he's making a lot in downloads and sales, he could turn around and pass that saving on to his audience, because he's doing an arena tour with $25 seats, packing it. So basically, he's not whoring himself out just to make this extra money. He's finding a way to benefit his fans. I wanted to kind of get your take on the way that, like, maybe indie or rock treats branding against, like, what country artists treat it.
I think the touring example is actually an interesting one, because we've definitely done a lot of that with, especially the Green Label Sound tours we've done, where we've been able to give artists you know, enough tour support and set it up so, you know, they can just sell a $5 ticket or a $10 ticket, which is really important to definitely a lot of artists we work with, and I would imagine labels or artists on your labels as well. You know, so I think taking advantage of it is, you know, the same things are there. I just think it's a different mindset. I think you know, a lot of hip hop is also similar from that standpoint where brands have become a part of the story, especially with mainstream hip hop. I'll never forget, this is like in the heyday, like five or six years ago now, probably. It was like hate when 50 Cent was really on top of the hip hop world. I remember walking up the street and I was behind a group of kids and they were having a conversation about, and it was 50 Cent, and I forget who the other artist was, Jay or someone else that was massive, and what they were arguing about was literally their brand relationships. Like, oh, he's got that Reebok deal, and he's got that. And I was like, man, these are kids talking about this stuff that are like passionate about it because it's like almost part of like
the culture
of like what makes their artists that much more important. Which I think only, you know, I think that's really extreme, but I think that's happened in hip hop as well. I just think there's I don't know what brings it on, but I think there's a different ethos that still lives, probably set forth by the people before them, by mm-hmm. right. you know, the Sonic Youths of the world and, yeah. right. and before that.
Maybe with mainstream music and whatever top 40 or country or whatever, I think it all comes down to mainstream America that goes to these kind of shows and stuff is already so inundated with branding through sports and
yeah.
everything else. They're not even affected by anymore. You know, you used to do Kenny Chesney, you have like Curzon rum.
Oh my God, he's like eight kinds of rum. That's so drunk, his fans.
Yeah.
You go into stadiums now, and it's
2 minutes. I see that.
So what does it matter?
Right. And I think it is a different consumer too. I think the consumer that's consuming a lot of this indie music is spending time on these blogs and these places where you see them like they're ruthless and like, you know, it's more important to the consumer and it makes it that much more important to their band. And you see some of those bands as they start to reach a more mass consumer, sometimes their appetite for relationships starts to evolve along with that.
Well, and from our perspective, it's just a culture that is counterculture,
and
it's, you know, it's just that is not something that we've ever embraced on a massive scale. It's, you know, it's we don't want to do what everyone else is doing. So mainstream is the exact opposite of where our artists usually want to be.
That's where we are as
and
well.
And so it's a tough road for us, you know, to figure out, but I think it's working. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, at least at Sub Pop, most of our artists are very open. And we're open as well, and it's just, you know, finding the right fit, and does that actually help the artist, or, you know, what are we getting out of it, what is the artist getting out of it, and does it work for us and the brand as well?
I think we have time for one more question, if anyone wants to ask or has the mic, or I don't know where the mic is. And while she's getting the mic, I'll say one more thing, which is that I think country artists think of making music as a form of labor. Like, it's a job as well as an art. And Nashville's all set up like that. And I mean, you were talking, Jen, about how there's a lot of labor involved sometimes in promoting these brands. So
yeah.
Maybe that's another reason why it's easier for them to absorb the message.
All right, cool. Thanks again, everybody, for talking. I really enjoy all your different perspectives. And I just was wondering, when you're approaching, you know, brands as a label or if they're approaching you, what's the kind of mix, what's the ratio of like product versus financial support, you know, that you can expect? And are there different like gradients or like the indie grassroots level versus, you know, a major label? And is that reflective of the, like, how do you measure the value of the band itself? How does the brand measure the value of the band? Is it through their Facebook likes or their YouTube hits or...
Oh, I think it's a combination. It definitely depends on the artist, but it's a combination of how the brand measures. You know, nowadays everybody looks at their Facebook and their Twitter. It's like that's the first, like, well, do they have over 1 million? Okay, good. Let's see what we can go from there. That's like the first thing now, especially for me, I do digital, so that's the first thing they look at. How many impressions can you deliver? How many people visit their website? How many people are subscribed to their email list? So that's all a big part of it. But it definitely depends on the individual artist and depends on the brand, how you're going to go to the next step as to what you're asking from them and what you're willing to give from your artist.
Yeah, I think there's clearly, like, if we go into something, we have a clear feel for the different compensation levels it might require based on the size of the band and those things. I think in addition to all of those things, we also a lot of times will look at, especially for bigger bands, at their ability to tour. Because I think it's a great insight into a band about how many tickets they can sell from a touring standpoint, and I think that really gives you a feel for their communities in addition to their social media communities and other avenues. they may have. And then, you know, I think there's a relationship with the artist that's created. And then, you know, certainly if it's a relationship that does ask them to record music, then obviously then there's a relationship with, if somebody already owns the rights to that music, like a record label or a publisher, then there's a separate relationship typically, you know, that would might be created with them to compensate them for their involvement.
You mean like if a brand wanted to license the song and that would be the partnership was through licensing?
Right, or if it just that was part of the partnership. So,
right.
You know, sometimes it might just be like one piece of the partnership, but it's still something that at that point, you know, there's compensation, and of course compensation levels based on the size of the artist and song again that would go to the...
Yeah, like, it seems to me that when the companies come to artists that they consider to be baby bands or smaller developing artists, they believe that they're offering something in the way of exposure and promotion and that they therefore don't need to pay dollars, you know, big money. And I'm pretty sure that that factors into the kind of bands that they decide that they want to go after. If they have a huge budget for artists and music, you know, why not get this, you know, platinum-selling group? And if they don't want to spend a lot of money, then they're going to get the exposure and they're going to go try to find a smaller band where they feel like they can get, you know, they have some negotiating leverage to do it for not much.
Yeah, I've always been surprised. We've been approached by some massive, massive companies that are publicly traded, so you know exactly how much money they have. And they will offer a tiny bit of money because they know the promotional value of associating yourself with that brand is basically payment enough.
Well, or they believe that. And I'm not always sure that that's true. And because of some of the negative aspects of being associated with a brand, it may be, you know, a negative thing for the artist. So that's why I say it's not always the case that we move forward on these things. It just depends.
I think, yeah, and I think brands sometimes have completely unrealistic expectations about what they're bringing to the table and what they expect to get back. Like, completely unrealistic.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, it's a challenge to make them see the light.
Yeah.
On this side, when that's who they're, you know, I have to make them happy. But, you know, I think on the flip side, I think sometimes, and for the most part, no, labels will price stuff back if based on, or managers or other, you know, other people around talent, based on the size of the brand. Like, man, well, that brand's got a lot of money. I know you can pay me this, you know,
right.
And it's like...
Yeah. So it's just as crazy
and
on
honestly,
that side.
If Bill Gates buys a cheeseburger, you don't double the price. It's the cheeseburger costs what the cheeseburger costs, no matter who's buying it, you know what I mean? So I think, not to objectify an artist like that, but I'm just saying, it's not about how much money's in the wallet of the brand necessarily, but I do think sometimes that's the expectation on the other side.
And on that note, I think we really have to end, but I would just say, have a good lawyer, artists. And thank you so much.
Yeah, exactly. Have a very good representative.
All of your insights.